Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. In fifth grade, Miren Fader became the first girl to join her elementary school's all-boys basketball team. The boys didn't like it, they didn't pass her the ball, they guarded her tougher than usual, even pushing her to the ground and sending her to the emergency room once. But she loved the challenge, so she kept coming back. She's still coming back. Hoops led her to writing, writing led her back to hoops. Prior to the Bleacher Report, she contributed features to ESPN.com, ESPNW. Before that, she got her start as a staff writer for the Orange County Register from 2013 to 17. While writing for the Register, Miren wrote any feature she could get her hands on, from Cal State Fullerton basketball to SoCal Japanese basketball leagues to Little League sports. She's also written for Sports Illustrated, Slam Magazine, Los Angeles Daily News, and SB Nation. She graduated from Occidental College in 2013. Before attending Occidental, she played basketball her freshman year at Lewis and Clark College. She will always love the game. Now she's a staff writer for The Ringer, writing long-form, human interest features on all sports. Her goal is to tell interesting, compelling stories about people that happen to play sports. She's profiled some of the biggest names in sports, from NBA to NFL to NCAA to WNBA to high school and to youth sports. She's the author of the book, Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP, based on her profile of two-time NBA MVP Giannis Antetokounmpo and his youngest brother, Alex. The book was released August 10th, 2021 by Hatchet Books. You can buy the book anywhere you buy books. So here I am with Miren Fader, and you see the book right over my, I guess my right shoulder. What a book. And we were just talking before we started recording here. I mean, how do you not become a Giannis fan if you weren't before? And if you're already a big one, how does he not become your favorite player? So thank you so much for writing this book. Obviously the timing is incredible, right?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, thanks for having me on. Yeah.
Welcome.
I definitely did not think the books were going to win a title at all. As you know, a lot of the book is like the Bucks have struggled since forever.
Yes. So maybe you're one of the haters that Giannis was playing for. Okay. All right. So we have you on record.
Hater. it's important to put the history in. I think he came at the perfect time. This franchise was needing this. You know, it was on the brink of leaving, and Giannis just changed it all.
Right. As of maybe 2 weeks ago or so, the book hit number 3. Is that right? On New York Times bestseller?
Yeah. Yeah.
Congratulations. And
you
don't have to respond to this either way, but I feel like it's really number 1 or 2, because one of the books ahead of you was written by like a white supremacist. So like, you know what I mean? So
it's like, can you knock off Tucker? And
I'm like, yeah. Like, you know, at least number two. Congratulations. Obviously the timing is incredible and I'm sure that helped, but the book is so good. I grew up reading all the great sports biographies, you know, maybe geared more towards kids, and you figure like, oh, I've read them all. What more can I learn? I know something about Giannis, and wow. I mean, there's just so much to learn. And like I said, he's got a new favorite player. So once I closed that book, it was like, let me just share this with as many people as I can.
Wow. Oh, thank you so much. That really means a lot.
Did I read maybe on social media that with the paperback, there's going to be an update now that they've, of course, won the title?
Yes, okay. I'm in the process of writing this right now. So okay. It's going to be just like a little epilogue at the end. So, you know, who would have thought? Not me.
Right. Oh, my gosh. I'm stuck here in Sacramento as a long-suffering Kings fan.
Okay.
And a lot of what was written about Milwaukee and the, you know, small market and all that. I'm like, okay, so we're going to get a Giannis in the next couple of years.
That's all it takes.
And there we go. Right. So obviously you've had quite a career even before this. You know, did you grow up in Orange County? Am I getting that correct?
No, I grew up in LA, but I started my career in Orange County.
I don't know. Who are some of the like writers and or sports writers? I guess that's one and the same, who have inspired you throughout the years.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I love Wright Thompson. Okay. Love Jeff Perlman, Jonathan Abrams, Jackie McMullen, Jack McCollum. Okay. I just started reading his books, you know, when I was in like seventh grade, and John Feinstein, same thing. I have like all his books.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've always, you know, it's funny. I used to be a basketball player and I would read these because I just love basketball. But now that I'm an adult, I'm like reading them for the narrative, you know, the writing.
Yes. Yeah. In the first couple parts of your famous piece on Mambacita, you just, you know, it's just about the love of right. basketball and touching the ball and all that. How much of a baller were you? Are you? I mean, you can brag a little bit.
Well, pre-pandemic, I was still somewhat right? an athlete, and now I'm just washed and awful at everything, and I can't even run. It's just a sad story. It's like a wilted flower. But my whole life, I loved basketball. I wanted to be in the WNBA. I was that girl that had a ball at her hip every day. Right. Like K through high school. I played my first year in college, and yeah, you know, I'm also 5 feet tall, so it was an up battle the whole time, but pushed it as far as it could go. But yeah, I loved hustling. I loved defending. I loved being a point guard. I miss it, you know?
Right? Totally. I had such a great run going right before the pandemic, like, you know, twice a week, and
we're in a group.
I'm a little older, and so, you know, found the right competition levels and all that. Now, like you said, man, if I can give you a story idea, right? I mean, about the Joe Schmoes, right, who have lost their will to play basketball or their ability to play basketball.
I'm like, can I interview me and all of my friends?
Not you. No. You're still young. You still have a long career ahead of you, you know? Was there, when the WNBA didn't work out, was there a eureka moment maybe, or eureka moments with writing where it was like, dang, I can do this thing, and or I, you know, I love this.
Yeah, so at my first college, when I was playing, I went to Lewis and Clark College, and basketball was just this awful experience. And I took this class called Women Writers, and it was all women. It was my first class that was like just women, and we were reading all these famous women writers, and the professor was like telling us how writing was really almost forbidden for women at first, and like women weren't supposed to hold the pen. And there's just like something so badass about that, that I just, a light bulb went off, because I think part of what drew me to basketball was that I was the only girl, and I was used to competing in these like all male spaces and wanting to like prove myself. And I don't know, I'm just like a competitive person. And when my professor said that, it made me feel like that, you know, like yeah. wanting something that maybe I shouldn't. And then, you know, I was like, wait, like basketball's kind of ending. What if I did something with writing and basketball? And the wheels kind of kept turning.
Wow. Shout out to Lewis and Clark is in Oregon, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
My dad's high school coach named Bob Gaylord was there for many years. I think he coached the men's team, but okay. may have been 10 or 15 years at least now. Who were you reading in that class?
Oh my gosh. So we read Toni Morrison, which inspired a lifelong, you know, love of Toni Morrison, just incredible. God, Kate Chopin, Jane Austen, Toni Cade Bambara, Virginia Woolf. I mean, I just became like this giant nerd, you know, right. I was like, okay. Cause it was always like that in basketball. Like I vividly remember a summer AAU tournament and I was taking AP classes. So I had to do summer reading, and I was reading Candide by Voltaire off the side before our game. My coach looked at me like, what the fuck are you? And so I always just felt so out of place, you know? And then finally I became a sports writer, and it was like all of that literary ambition and love was able to finally, like, it was okay to feel that way. Those things.
Help me with the chronology a little bit. So like, have you like been incredibly recently hired on the Ringer, or have you been concurrently with the Bleacher Report?
Yeah. So I started at the Ringer pretty recent, December 2020.
Okay.
So
yeah.
I was at, so I started my career, I graduated in 2013 from Occidental College, and then I went to the Orange County Register 2013 to 17, okay. And then I was at Bleacher 2017 to 2020, and then right at the end of the year, I started at Ringer, so.
Wow, okay. Say what's up to Shea Serrano and Bill Simmons for you next time.
I will.
My brother's line, he once said this in front of his girlfriend. He said, "No offense, but my soulmate is Bill Simmons."
Yeah, it's funny because all my guy friends and all my basketball friends, they're like, listen to all the podcasts and
right.
It's just very funny. Like, how's this person? Such a fan.
Oh man. Well, you're going to be up there. You're going to be, you know, taught. You're going to be in those shelves in back of you. You're going to be taught in colleges in the future and all of that. I mean, because your stuff is so good. The Mambacita piece, which, you know, obviously I wish it wouldn't have gone viral. Do you know? I mean, I'm sure you agree because of, I mean, just the immense sadness of Gigi. But just the way it's written, I mean, it's just, they're vignettes. They're quick, and they just build the tension. How did you decide to write it that way instead of, you know, maybe focusing on like one anecdote or one story out of her life? Like, I mean, there were, I don't know, seven or eight or more.
Yeah, I've never written a story like that ever. It really was bizarre. I, you know, I was trying to write the story and it just wasn't working. And I think this was so traumatic and it was so awful. And every way I tried it just wasn't connecting emotionally. And it felt, you know, how do you start a story with like a basketball scene? Like, that's not appropriate, you know? And like, how do you present this? It's like it's an obituary / feature, you know? I just was struck by the way that the people I was, you know, doing reporting with, how their memories kept coming out and how they would say one thing and then their mind would switch to another memory. And I wanted the structure of the piece to kind of mirror that, because right. I feel like that's how memories naturally unfold, especially in a trauma situation.
Yes. So
the hope was that, you know, form would mirror the content. And it also, I think the material is so heavy that you almost needed pauses between. So the ellipses like literally make you stop and contemplate what you just, you know, and like really take that in. So yeah, that was what I was thinking.
Thank you for putting words to that. I mean, that, yes, that all makes sense. Like you said, but, you need that break.
Right. Right. Yeah. So some of my closest friends were like, I can't get through this piece. I love you. I'm sorry.
Uh-huh. You know? Understandable. Oh, for sure. I, you know, the way that you end with, I don't know if it's pronounced Capri or Capri, the youngest, I mean, heartbreaking.
Yeah, I just kept thinking of her, right? Like, how does she then learn the story of not just her dad, but her sister, you know?
Right.
Because I think the girls are constantly like taken out of the story. They're just like footnotes in Kobe's obituary, you know? Yes. And it's just really sad that there was no focus on them.
Yeah, I was at a wedding a week ago and we were just a couple miles away and the host pointed and said, that's where Kobe's accident happened. And it just took the air out of everything. Right. I mean, it's still fresh. And I feel like it's going to be fresh for so long.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and I feel sometimes like that hashtag, like, you know, hashtag girl dad thing is almost kind of overdone and almost sexist in its own way, but hashtag girl dad, like Kobe, you know, coming out of retirement, like you talked about, to be a coach, like he said he was never going to coach.
Yeah.
Oh, just heartbreaking. I keep coming back to that.
Yeah. He really was about to coach them, like he was about to take them at this high school. So yeah, and then, you know, the Mamba team isn't called the Mambas anymore.
Oh no.
So it's just, it's like a part of identity gone. It's really.
Yes. Yeah, like retiring a number, just retire the name. I mean, it makes sense. Another SoCal story was, you know, Tyler Skaggs, and having lived in LA for a while, I knew the story. And, you know, he has the Orange County connection, obviously, with the baseball team and then Santa Monica as well. And you did such a good job of humanizing him.
Thank you.
I mean, it's one thing to say, I understand that, you know, there can be addictions and that's a disease and it's not, but you really gave so many specifics, the teddy bear that had the voicemail and the voice and just the things that his mom remembered. It really stuck out to me when she kind of not slipped up, but she was honest and she said, you know, I'm also mad at him.
Right. That was probably the most chilling quote I've ever heard in my entire career. And, you know, if I was an exploitative journalist, I would have put it in line one.
Right.
Because it does a disservice to the complexity of hurt feelings, the complexity of the situation. Yeah. I put it at the end because, like, and that wasn't my original end. I actually had a different ending at first and we ended up changing it. But, like, this is not a story that you can tie a bow on.
No.
And I think that sometimes in sports journalism, we try so hard to make it nice at the end. Like, he's going to live on in the memories of, she's going to be haunted by this forever.
Yeah.
And quality of life is, but this happened and I will move on, you know? And so I just really wanted to keep it real about that. But also, like, imagine you live your whole life. You're a devoted husband, you know, a loving son, a great teammate, a great ball player, and your whole life is reduced to Tyler Skaggs dies at whatever of an overdose. Mm-hmm. And to me, I'm like, that is so horrible. And like, why is there no humanity in talking about this person? Like, who knows what happened, you know? So I just wanted to just tell people about who he was.
Yes, you're right. It could have been so reductive, but it wasn't. I love the, what was it? I'm okay. I don't know how the emphasis would be, but that little, the inside joke that he had with his mom.
Right.
Those are things that humanize people for sure.
Because that's the image and the voice that she hears, you know, and it kind of goes back to the Gigi thing. Like, you know, I'm sure it's with same with you and me, but like when we remember stuff, we remember little details like that. We don't always remember the whole thing, you know, but these little things are clear to us.
Yes, no doubt about it. I, you know, we all have those, unfortunately, you know, the people who have passed away are way too young, and it reminded me of him, and but also in some positive ways that, you know, to remember those, the inside jokes and those bits. So thanks again. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how you close that book, Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an MVP, and don't just say like, this guy is incredible. This guy, how he's my favorite player. Did you see him buying, you know, Chick-fil-A for everyone after the NBA finals? Like, I can't wait for the paperback because it's going to have, like you said, the, you know, the addendum. How far back does that book go? Like, how far back does the research go? The idea?
Honestly, I wrote the proposal in December, 2019, because I did the story on him and his brother in July, 2019. Mm-hmm. A couple months later, I turned in the proposal. We shopped it around like January, February of 2020, and then signed the deal mid-March 2020, right when the pandemic happened. And then it was due March 1st, 2021. So I only had 1 year, and normally, and during a pandemic year at that. So normally, you know, books take 2-3 years, but I only had 1 year because we wanted it to come out at this time because we weren't sure if he was going to stay or leave. Right. So free agency would be the peg. And so I had a very shortened time to report and write this. And that's why on the cover, he doesn't have a Bucks jersey, because we didn't know if he
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. That's why. And of course, because he's looking up and, you know, eyes are a motif in the book, but that all worked out. But yeah, that there's a conscious decision to not put a Bucks jersey on.
Whoa. There. So I don't know if you look on the ground around you, you dropped a big word there, motif. I love it. The English teacher in me loves that. Yes. I explain it to my students and 95% of the time, I understand what I'm talking about.
Everyone's like, what are you even?
to date myself a little bit, but for the old video games where like Michael Jordan, he would be like player 99.
Yeah.
Because of licensing, you know, and that's so funny. I was thinking of course, you know, blowing on his hands and looking up, but. Wow.
Right.
Oh my gosh. I love how the prologue starts. First of all, I love epigraphs. I love the prologue that having as a teacher, having taught things fall apart. Right. In the Igbo culture, especially about how important proverbs are.
Right.
So I loved how you'd had a Greek and a Nigerian proverb. Is that kind of like to show both sides of him, his multifacetedness?
Yeah, I think there's both like attention and I guess a pride for these two major parts of him. Mm-hmm. And these two parts of him really define everything that comes next in his life.
Sure.
Whether how he feels about himself and his family or how he and his family are treated. Yeah. And I do think that he contends with both of those identities throughout his life and the book. And So I knew I wanted to do two of them, because sometimes people only focus on his Greek side and they miss the Nigerian side, or sure. You see him as Black and they refuse to see him as Greek. So I wanted to be clear from the jump, like, this is, both of these things are major parts of him.
Right. That story that starts off the prologue, like, sums them up so well. The family, the skateboard, right. The skateboard and the refrigerator, right?
Right. And then they laugh because here's this harrowing moment where they're getting evicted, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they have to be scrappy and resourceful. There's no time to cry. And then they put it on this skateboard and then they're just laughing with pride. And I think I really wanted to show joy alongside the adversity. Yeah. Sometimes we go so into trauma, we forget about happiness. And that was a very lighthearted moment after a really, really harrowing moment.
No doubt about it. You talk about how, you know, growing up in Athens. So the neighborhood is called Sopolia. Is that like a district or neighborhood, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of, you know, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just gonna say there's many little tiny, you know, enclaves within Athens. And Sopolia is this very like bustling working class area within Athens.
Right. You described the parents who had moved, I want to say 91.
Yeah.
And so Jonas was born in 94.
Yeah.
Right. And just, you know, this idea in, you know, obviously in the United States, we have this, you know, about citizenship and undocumented, this and that, like Jonas is without citizenship.
Right.
He's neither Nigerian in citizenship nor Greek. And so, I mean, you talk about obviously the limbo, his parents, the same thing. You describe it so well in so many ways. And I mean, the literal hunger that they had on a daily basis and, you know, the beauty of the family, but, you know, talk about a trickle down effect, starting with the parents. Like, no, you go ahead and eat. You go ahead and eat.
Right.
Go ahead and eat. How much, I wonder how much, how many interviews or how much you got to speak more directly or to the parents.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately,
Charles had passed away before then. Maybe.
Charles had passed away, which was really unfortunate, but I spent like almost an hour with the mom, Veronica. And the thing that I really appreciated was that she didn't want to talk about anything about basketball, like how good Giannis was or any of the brothers. She just kind of repeated, you know, very kind person, very kind brother, very kind, you know, he teaches them how to sacrifice. Like those are the things that she wanted to emphasize. So, I wanted the hunger, like I called it hunger, the chapter one, because I think there's like a double hunger.
Oh, yeah.
There's literal hunger, and then there's like a desire to advance, to excel, to survive. Like there's different kinds of hunger that Giannis experiences.
Yeah, I want to talk about the metaphorical hunger in a second. I'd known a pretty good amount about Giannis, and as I'm reading and as you're describing the parents and how incredible they were and how they would push, but not too hard. They're not the yellers and screamers at the soccer games or the basketball games. They would encourage and have little aphorisms. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, oh no, Charles pass away? And I felt that like it was a fresh, you know, fresh death. I mean, I just so sad for the family, not even knowing them. And it just hit hard. It was like, oh my gosh. And that's what great, you know, books can do, is make you really get to know and love and feel, you know, as much empathy as you possibly can for the characters.
Yeah. It's just so, I just think it's so interesting that Giannis's whole life essentially was preparing to be a father in a way. Like he was always like a leader of his brothers and always like, I don't know, just matured at a really young age because he had this wonderful role model in his dad.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after his dad died, it really pushed Giannis into that role even more. But it's just so awful because, you know, Charles was so young and it's like we went through everything. I thought we were okay now, and then boom, you know. So it's Giannis is, you know, he's inspired a lot of my friends who have had a parent die. It's you know, look at this guy, he just goes out and scores 40 points after all of this, you know.
Right.
Who can do that?
Right. The beautiful description of, I mean, of the family, and you know, same bedroom, same bed.
Yeah.
You know, Giannis, I think maybe I'm mixing up stories, but soon after he got his first contract or was about to sign, you know, he was a rich man, but he and his brother were like, no, why would we get two hotel rooms? And, you know, he got a Yukon for his first car, like a used one. Right. And, you know, just the parents and the way that they, like I said, took care of the kids and provided that painting. Can you talk a little bit about the painting that you described that I think has the quote on it?
The I Am My Father's Legacy one?
Yeah.
Yeah, there. If you go in their basement, they have this like giant mural kind of painting, and it says I Am My Father's Legacy, and it has all of the brothers kind of like doing some basketball moves. So one layup, or one is like shooting, and one is play, and it has the parents' names. And right when, as you're looking at it, you go to the left, and that's like where they train. They have a weight room under there, so like the first thing that they see, and it's like just reminds them of of their purpose, and you know, everything is for their dad at this point.
Oh man. And then you ended so well with, you know, ideas of home and, you know, signing, you know, is he going to sign? Is he not? Is he staying in Milwaukee? He obviously did. And then, you know, Liam, am I saying it right?
Yeah, little baby.
He's probably what, maybe two or three now?
Yeah. He's got to be like two now, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. He was born in February 2020.
Oh shoot. He's not even two yet. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Right before the pandemic. Yeah. Going back to their life in Greece, I mean, literally going to practice, hungry, people helping out, a lot of people helping, a lot of his teammates, a lot of their families. I don't remember the woman's name, Sergaridu, maybe, is it right? Yeah. You know, and his friend Rana, who's, you know, Pakistani immigrants, the cafe owner, again, a lot of the teammates. How do you square that with the blatant virulent racism that he faced? You know, I knew in general about the terrorist group Golden Dawn, but I mean, just disgusting.
Yeah.
How do you, and then, you know, I'm sorry to cut you off real quick, but just the idea of like, you know, that the hypocrisy of like celebrating him, he's Greek. Yeah. After all the stuff he was put through, some of the comments from some of the people who are in government, just like, wow, how do you square those?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing is just that, you know, before I wrote the book, Giannis's story has been framed as this feel good narrative because
it's
inspirational and it is so awesome and miraculous. But like this whole like rags to riches, you know, it just sugarcoats awful racism that he experienced. And the only thing you heard about really were like, look at all these kind Greeks that helped him and loved him. And it's very Disneyfied, right? Disneyfied. And I think, you know, I knew he had to experience racism because that's just literally what happens around the world, especially in places like Greece or other European countries, especially at that time, especially if you're an undocumented immigrant. But you never really heard stories about that with Giannis because they talk about it. And so it was just always swept under the rug. And so for me, I was finding both, you know, that there were so many white Greeks that treated him with dignity and respect and really went out of their way to help him when they did not have to, and that don't want the credit for it at all.
Okay.
Just really nice, genuine people, because they didn't know Giannis was going to become Giannis. He was not good at basketball. They were doing this because they saw a kid in need, and it's true and it's genuine. But there are a lot of people back then and now that were so racist to him that would shout racist things at games. You mentioned Golden Dawn. This is a criminal organization that would scour through neighborhoods for people that looked like Giannis. And so, you know, people have a really hard time holding both of these in their heads, but they're both true. I think the thing that people even know less about, let alone the racism back then, is that it still occurs now. You know, you could not find a better ambassador for your country than Giannis.
No.
He represents the Greek country with such pride, dignity, class, and excellence and grace. And you have literal prominent politicians going on TV calling him awful racist things and swastikas being drawn on his mural. So really, it's a long-winded way of saying like Greece can be both proud and can hate Giannis at the same time. They can both embrace him and shun him. He can be both accepted as Greek and never accepted as Greek. He himself can love Greece, even if it does not always love him. It's complicated. It's not an easy sports narrative. Like, wow, country, you know, the Greek freak, love it. Sure. It's much darker.
Yes. And I appreciate how you not juxtaposed, but I guess you connected that with, you know, especially what happened in Milwaukee with Jacob Blake and the protests and just the general George Floyd, Milwaukee as the most segregated city in the United States, showing us it's no place is exempt from. And it's not like we can sit here as Americans and say, ah, those Greeks.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, or vice versa, you know. has managed to be so innocent and fun loving, you know, for the most part. You do talk a lot about his drive and how he would especially get so mad at himself, and I'm sure still does, because he has that drive to be great.
Right.
The idea of him as a kid-like, childlike.
Yeah.
You had a good touch with that in the book, because like you said, that could become like a Disney fight, like, yay, no problems, no issues, he's great. Any stories maybe that didn't make it into the book that kind of made you laugh? Like, oh man, like what a great guy. He's so fun.
Oh, that's such a good question. Giannis loves corn dogs. And
okay.
When he first had a corn dog, he was just like, oh my God, like the concept of a corn dog, like, oh my goodness, you know? And like, just.
It's true. He's not wrong.
He's not wrong.
He's
not wrong. Giannis and food, the Bucks chef, you know, I know I included that he would do like a bison bowl, but he had the Bucks team chef create Greek dishes for him,
okay,
but an American twist. And that always like tickled him, like, oh yeah, okay, souvlaki, huh? American, it's like nothing compared to like back home, but
yeah.
He just, it was like Giannis, the way I look at it is like Giannis acts like he just got to the NBA every day. He is like lit up. Like he is somebody that's just like, we're playing basketball today. You know, it reminds me so much of like the first time somebody makes varsity. That's Giannis. Yeah. That's Giannis every day. Yeah. You know, the first time varsity practice, you're nervous. You're like, oh my God, this is such a big deal. Oh, I got to make the team. I got to do this. Mm-hmm. That's Giannis as a two-time MVP and champion.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. The book is so incredible, talking about that hunger. It's, I've been having conversations with, you know, friends and colleagues and stuff just about like sports specifically, but also not in sports. How do you can't, I mean, obviously he's an extreme case of hunger, yeah, but like, how do you inculcate that in someone, you know, that hunger where he, like you talk about, I mean, he would spend the whole day, like almost literally at the gym. The idea of, you know, what if we all went to sleep and woke up when we were back where we started? That's what the brothers would say to each other.
Right.
And it seems like he truly believes that.
He really does. I mean, it's the same thing. Like you're a teacher. You can tell your students till you're blue in the face that if they want to become a better reader, then they have to read every day.
Mm-hmm.
If they want to learn how to write better, they have to read every day. But you literally can't make someone read, right?
No.
You can do homework, you can make it, but you can't.
We try.
Right, but you can't make them have that natural curiosity.
No.
Right? It's in you. And some students, you'll notice they have it and you love it. And some, they're just never going to have it. Mm. That's honest, because like he had it because he watched his parents have it. Like they never had to say, you need to work hard. And sure, they like maybe said that sometimes, but sure. It was like, wow, I'm watching my mom come home at, you know, 1 a.m. We only had enough to get, you know, a tiny bit. And she just brought this home for me to eat. And look how happy she is, even though this is a horrible day. That's work. Like that's sacrifice, you know, okay, my dad looks like he's happy. I know he's not happy. We just got evicted again. And he hasn't eaten in 2 days. Oh my God. Look at the way he's like, these are things like children are very smart. And Giannis, you know, is a really smart person. And he absorbed these ideals of hunger and work ethic and sacrifice and desire. And so, you know, everything he does now, I'm like, oh, duh, like, look at how you grew up. Like it's, you had that ingrained into you. Nobody ever, they have to tell him to stop working, you know, like they have to tell him like, you're going to hurt yourself if you keep going. But the fear of losing out on something because of all this childhood trauma that we've been talking about is so present that like, he can't stop and he won't stop. Just won't.
Right. Yeah. In the book, you paint such a great picture of the family. You're like, okay, I know, you know, one guy's in the G League and the Lakers and this and that. And like, but obviously they have their own stories too.
Right.
I'm looking out for little Alex, who's not so little anymore, but.
Did you see him on the summer league team?
They
just won a championship. He was on that Sacramento.
I know they won the championship. Okay. I'm going to go out and check that out. Thank you for that. Oh my gosh.
He looks so grown in this picture. You go back to the bleacher story that I wrote on Alex Giannis, and you'll see he looks like a baby kind of.
Okay.
Look at him at the Sacramento. He's grown. He looks bigger. I mean,
wow.
But I really wanted to include that because like I think it's miraculous that none of them are jealous of Giannis. Like genuinely not jealous. Like, I know, you know, with my sister, like when she would get things, I'd be like, oh my God. You know, like that doesn't
nature, right?
It's like this family moves differently. They think differently. Like Alex, you know, the quote in the book where he was like, we never fought because nobody had anything individual to us. And so that's just continued into adulthood. And like, think of Thanasis, who had to watch his younger brother become a star when he was still fighting for a G League roster spot. You know, they were never jealous of each other.
Yeah, I mean, the book is a love story among the family. It's obviously there's actually, you know, there's X's and O's and hoops in there talking about his development. The, you know, you described so well him being so fun loving, all those buddies he had on the training staff and all that, how he treats everyone with so much dignity. And, you know, you don't Mickey Mouse it up, like you said, with, I mean, you talk about the ugly stuff that happened.
Right.
I guess the last question for you is, you may have realized that he won an NBA Finals, NBA Championship. Yes. So, right. And then we talked about that already, obviously. So what were you, I don't know, what were you thinking as you were watching that? Like, I mean, were you rooting like Bucks? Or are you like, I'm an objective sports writer? Like, what's your connection to Giannis now, I guess?
Well, like normally I'm so old school. I'm like, I will not let my sources buy me a coffee. Like I am just old school as it gets, no cheering. Press box. We have that line. I'm not your friend, whatever. But, you know, I just have such compassion for his story and his journey. And obviously, like, I'm rooting for myself as well, because it's very, very, very hard for a sports book to break into nonfiction literary world. And if the Bucks did well, the book would do well. And so I was just cheering so hard for the Bucks. But it's all, I feel that way with, you know, even without a book, like LaMelo Ball, I did those two stories on him. I spent so much time with him in like Lithuania and Australia. When I saw him win Rookie of the Year, like, I'm not gonna lie, I felt really happy. I felt good for him. Like, what a good kid. Like, you know, like not a kid anymore. He's a man, but you know, I knew him when he was not knew him, but I covered him when he was a kid. And you know, feature writing is this weird form of intimacy that you're granted, in no other space in real life, where you need to ask a very famous person really vulnerable questions, and you do so without a, you know, trust or license that's built up over time. And so naturally you just feel a closeness to them and their stories, and you find yourself rooting for them after you no longer speak to them and you don't have a reporter writer subject relationship. And I think definitely, you know, I was thinking about Giannis for a year.
Yes. I lied. Last question. Do you know if he's read the book?
I don't know. They were the first to get it months ago.
Okay.
I really love it. I really do.
I bet. I love it. I'm one of many, 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 many. Congrats on the book. Like you said, it's got to be really hard to break in with a sports book. It's not just a sports book.
Right.
Really well done. I'm going to be in my little, you know, corner of the world promoting it like crazy. You got to read this. You got to read this. Physically giving it to people, giving my copy, buying it for presents. And definitely rooting for Giannis.
Yes.
Right. And rooting for you and your continued careers. Great luck to you. I'm so happy to be able to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, this was so great. Thank you for asking me to come on.
Such a pleasure.
A big thank you to Miren Fader for being on the Chills at Will podcast. I know she's very sought after these days, as she should be, and it's really cool to see all the praise from her fellow writers online, because she is definitely highly respected. Thanks again to Miren Fader. Thank you for listening to episode 76 with Miren Fader. You can now subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave me a 5-star review. You can also ask for the podcast by name using Alexa. Find it on Stitcher, Spotify, and on Amazon Music. Follow me on Instagram, where I'm at Chills at Will Podcast, or on Twitter, where I'm at Chills at Will PO1, the number one. You can watch other episodes on YouTube, as well as this one. Watch and subscribe to the Chills at Will podcast channel. And please retweet, retweet, retweet. This is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation, and I'd love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look in an often ignored art form. The intro song for the Chills of Will podcast is Wind Down, instrumental version, and the other song played on the episode was Hoops Instrumental by Matt Whitehour, and both songs are used through archesaudio.com. I'm excited to share my next episode with Danielle Fuentes Morgan, professor at Santa Clara University, Go Broncos, and author of Laughing to Keep from Dying, African-American Satire in the 21st Century. We had a lot of fun. The episode airs on September 7th. For now, thanks again for listening, and I hope that these quarantine days bring you texts by writers with mad skills, like Mirren Fader, whose Giannis and other work give you chills at will. Thank you.